time is 7 o'clock.
Just want to ride on the motorcycle.
Sorry, Arlo, but tonight we don't have time for your motorcycle song. It's always great. You introduce it introduce us every week. But tonight we've got a guest who's got to be on stage at the Adelaide Fringe within the hour. So we'll have to come back to you later. Our guest tonight has appeared on Top Gear, The Fifth Wheel, countless motorcycle programs and the odd comedy show here and there. Finally, he can add the award-winning Coast FM Motor Chat to his resume. It's with great pleasure that we talk to a real mad motorcycle enthusiast who also happens to be a stand-up comedian, Ross Noble. Following Ross, we'll be talking to Stephen Matthews, class winner and world champion in his class at from the iconic Salix Beach Road Beach Racing event. Good evening, Ross. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Yes, nice to chat with you. Like to say, I'm currently backstage about my show. It's just after 8 tonight, so I'm reclining in a backstage area.
Sounds good. So, of course, our listeners will excuse a little bit of noise that may possibly come through every now and then. There's not much we can do about it, but certainly going to be worthwhile talking to you. And it's great. We really do appreciate the time you're giving us.
Yep. That's all right. Always happy to talk about bikes. It's the flip side of... it's kind of like my wife's in Melbourne at the moment, so I'm here by myself. So, whenever I start talking about motorbikes and she's around, it's nice to have a conversation where there isn't somebody rolling their eyes while I'm chatting.
So this is a real passion for you, is it?
Very much so, yeah. It started off as... when I was a kid, I was... I would have loved to have had a bike, but I was into push bikes, and my mum was one of those mums that was like absolutely not, you know, dead set against bikes. So I didn't start riding till I was 17, you know, and I moved to London, and I bought one of those pizza delivery bikes, a 50cc Honda City Express bike, you know. So I was riding a pizza bike for a while, and then that's far more dangerous than a proper bike. And I rode that for a while, and then and I used to do massive trips on it as well, you know, like bit by bit I just sort of initially it was just to get to shows and to, so I didn't have to go on public transport, but the bug bit me, and then it just some would say it got out of control, you know.
Nah,
no, never does.
We know about that.
So what speeds did you attain on your 50cc Honda?
It was not fast at all. In fact, there was one time I was coming back from there's a town called Southend, which must be, I don't know, 40 miles outside of London, maybe. And my mate, I said, oh, just come back on the back with me. So the thing did, I think it did about 45 or 50 mile an hour top speed. And with two of us on it, it did about 45 kilometres, 50 kilometres an hour with two of us on. So, yeah, it wasn't fast.
I can actually really relate to that. In my youth, I actually rode a Yamaha 100 from Adelaide to Whyalla. Now, that's 400 Ks, and by the time I got home, I was burnt to a crisp.
Right, but you know what? It's one of those things where, I maintain, it's one of those things where it sort of doesn't matter, you know, it sort of doesn't matter what the thing is. If it's got two wheels and it goes, then, you know, it's all fun, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, we've always enjoyed it. We often go out at the drop of a hat just for the heck of going out through the hills somewhere, finding a dirt road and riding around a little bit, just having a bit of fun. Now, your biography actually does say a lot. You've got on-road and off-road experience. So what's your preference?
I would say off-road is my... I was a road rider to start with, and then I started off road riding, and then what happened was I was doing big trips, so I did 26,000 kilometers around Australia, and I did a full loop, and then I zigzagged backwards and forwards, so it was Brisbane to Brisbane. But within that, I then went from Sydney to Adelaide to Melbourne and then back again. So yeah, so that ended up being 26,000 kilometres. And I think I rode pretty much every bit of tarmac in Australia. And after that, I was kind of like, oh, I'm a bit bored of road. So I started off, they call it green laning in the UK, but I suppose like bus riding or whatever. And then what happened was, so I got into that. We used to go off, as me and a couple of mates, and got really into riding, you know, trying to find sort of, off the beaten track, single track type stuff. Mm-hmm. And I really loved it. And then I was in Wales, and I went down, and we went for a, myself and, so there's this motorcycle, you might know him, in fact, you should talk to him, because there's a guy, Billy Ward, he's known as Billy Bike Truck. Have you heard of him?
No, I don't know him.
Okay, so basically, so Charlie Borman, you know, Ewan McGregor's mate, around the world and all that, your long way and all that, Billy and Charlie, Billy's kind of Charlie's right-hand man, and I've known Billy for years, and he's one of these guys who, they run these tours all over the world. They go across Africa and all that, and Billy, there's Simon Pavey, who runs the BMW off-road school down in Wales, which is where Ewan and Charlie had gone to learn the off-road stuff.
Yeah.
Billy and I had we'd gone down to have a ride with Simon Pavey, and the place where he runs his school, there's a they have a race there every year called the Dawn to Dusk, which is a 24-hour motorcycle race, and the Welsh countryside, like it's basically on a Welsh mountain, so you've got like, you know, it can be crazy hot or it can be chucking it down with rain. And this race, it starts at 7 o'clock on the Saturday, and you go through the night and then all the way through the next day, a full 24 hours, and it's big hill climbs, obviously hill climbs, steep descent, river crossings, you know, there's one bit where there's about half a mile of rocky stream that you have to ride up, and some people do it as a team of four, some do it as a pairing, some people do it solo. And we were down there, and I'd sort of ridden off road just recreationally, and we were in the pub, and the guy that runs the race, he says, oh, the race is next week, and he goes, why don't you enter it? And I'd never raced before, you know, I wasn't a kid who grew up doing motocross and stuff, and we'd never even done like a 3-hour local race. So I managed to convince Billy. I said, oh, it's been a bit of a laugh if we... I said, why don't we enter it as a two-man team and then just see if we can keep going for the full 24-hour. And then... and because he'd had a few drinks, he agreed to it. And so a week later, we managed to sort of cobble together... I was living in Australia at the time, so we didn't have any bikes or anything. So we cobbled together... We ended up with a Honda 450, which is completely inappropriate for that race, because there's a lot of technical stuff. So we, um, so So we turned up, and then on the day when we were signing in, the guy that ran it said, there's only three teams in the expert category. And he goes, so if one of those teams drops out, you'll be on the podium. So we thought this was hilarious, right? And we just went, because the thing about that race is sometimes you get the top riders and stuff can go wrong, bikes can break, you know, top riders can smash into trees and what have you. So we just thought, stuff it, we'll have a punt on it, you know. So the very first time I entered a race, it was as a two-man team in a 24-hour, and the battery was flat on the bike. another friend of ours, for a laugh, he said he worked for a clothing brand, and he said, "Oh, I'll sponsor you. So I'll get you some matching gear." So he turned up with this matching gear, and we thought he was being nice to us, but he came out with this fluorescent yellow, like tiger print stuff. So we're sat there, and Billy said, "You can start the start of the race." So I'm lining up. There was me and three expert top riders, all on the start line, and there's 200 riders behind who were starting in the clubman, the regular clubman race. So like literally, and the bike wouldn't start, and it was a. And then we got into the race, and about four or five hours in, Billy got so tired that he couldn't, he was cramping up. So I ended up doing the rest of the race by myself. And even though I was incredibly slow and I didn't know what I was doing, I got a real taste for it. So I then decided that I would enter solo. And then for the next 5 years, I basically went back and did it solo every year. And I kept getting faster, and it took me 5 years, and then finally I spent 6 months where I got a guy called James Burrows, who's like a top rider, but he trains off road riders and race car drivers and stuff. And then I trained with him for 6 months, and then I ended up winning it. And it was basically like I just spent 6 months where that was my entire focus. And doing that, it's such an extreme sort of crazy race. But then I had this sort of desire. I was going, well, what's next? You know, where do you go from there? And that's when I got into doing the extreme enduro. So I went and did like Red Bull Romaniacs and Roof of Africa and all the sort of the ones there. And then so when I said it got out of control, it really did get out of control.
First race, did you actually get up onto the podium?
No, bugger. Because it'd be a better story if I had. No, because it turns out the reason that those guys are experts, it's because they're experts.
they were
a lot faster than us, and it was essentially one man team with a sleepy guy who popped out, and I'd pull into the pit and go, right, do you want to go? And he'd be like, no, you go again. But it only took me 5 years to get onto the podium, you know.
Well, the important thing is that you got there. Actually, on a similar vein, we decided that when we wanted to start doing a little bit of dirt riding, we organised a training session with one of the Australian champion motocross rider, Shane Metcalf. And, Shane had always done his riding on a track, so therefore no reason to have a motorcycle licence. He reckons he didn't want to. And there he was teaching us, a group of 12 experienced riders, and he had an L plate on the back of his bike because he wanted to take us out bush, onto a public road, and so we had to get his license. And it looked just so hilarious that he was teaching us how to do this.
So that's it's quite funny actually, because Danny Webb, he was he used to race the 125 for Motor GP,
yep.
And then now he's doing Isle of Man TT, you know, he's on the roads now. And So I've known Danny for a while, and like, you know, you can imagine, like, he's been racing since he could, before he could walk, you know. He's kind of he's a very, very good rider. And yeah, when he wanted to when he went to get his motorbike license, it was one of those things, you know, they're doing that in Britain, you have a CVT, the compulsory bike training, and he was lined up with all the other teenage boys and you know, middle-aged men who had finally been allowed to get a motorbike. And the guy said, he said to him, ride up, and he said, and he told him about how to brake with a front brake. He said, ride up and really go hard on the brakes and stop at this line. So Danny, who was a bit feeling a bit bored and a bit mischievous, he rode up and did a 10-meter rolling stoppy on the front wheel, and then put it on the line, and then dropped the back of the bike down. And the guy just went, little bit hard. But it's true, actually. I mean, it's one of those things where, like, you know, I think that's why anyone who rides on the road should definitely, you know, I always say to people, if they're like, oh, you know, like, you don't have to go, like, hardcore with it, but I always say this to people, like, who, you know, are, like, avid road riders and stuff. Like, it's one of them things where, you know what it's like, and I've guys that have ridden on the tarmac for years and years, and then put them on the dirt, and it's like starting again, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's that thing of I just think, like, any of my mates who only ride on the road, I sort of I always get them on the dirt, because I just think it just makes you a better rider, it makes you a safer rider as well, you know, because you can just you know, you're just better on the brakes. And then I ride trials as well, you know, and I think that's one of those things where, you know, if I got near to want to go to the track and ride really fast, and I always say to them, get on a trials bike and go at walking speed, and that, you know, your throttle and your clutch control, then your balance, you know, to do that slowly. Like, trials is the hardest, you know, it's like all of the very best riders, you know, and all of those top MotoGP guys, they all play around on trials bike, because it just makes you so much better. Mm. So that's why I always say that to my mates. You know, if they want to, you know, if they want to get fast on the track, I just say, well, you know, leave that for a bit and learn to ride a trials bike, and you'll just be, you'll be better all around, you know.
You get learn bike control. Yeah. Mm. You learn bike control and all of that, so that's good.
Is that why you took up trials, just for another challenge?
Well, trials, there was a program in Britain, which was huge when I was a kid, a program called, God almighty, I've got out of my head now, Kickstart. So there was Kickstart, and then there was Junior Kickstart, and that was basically, it was televised trials. So, when we were kids, we all used to, you'd get on your push bike and you'd ride around doing trialsy stuff, like on your big heavy push bike. And, one of the things that, like, you know, certainly, like, with the extreme enduro stuff, with all disciplines of biking, the stuff that, you know, the people can ride trials, are just, you know, usually the people that are really skilled also ride trials as well. And that's kind of, that's one of the reasons. I was mucking about with the trials bike for years, but then it wasn't until I got right into it that I realized that, like, it's, you know, even just doing, like, simple stuff is really hard. But it's very, like, of all of the riding, like, that's the riding that I get most addicted to, because you can spend, you know, you can sort of spend 2 or 3 hours just in a tiny little, you know, in a tiny little patch of dirt with a couple of rocks and a few logs and stuff, and you can just, you know, just try and make the sections harder and harder, and you know, just try not to put your foot down. You know, it's definitely the most, for me anyway, it's the most addictive, you know. just because it's really hard.
Well, you did choose one of the hardest trials competitions to get into, and that was in 2017. You did the Scottish Sixdale Day Trials.
Yeah.
And we've all heard about those that particular competition. And you went into that event pretty much underprepared, didn't you?
Yeah, sort of. So what happened was we... The plan was we were going to do the same thing that we did for the 24 hour. You know, I was gonna take 6 months off, and I was just gonna train for 6 months, and then we were gonna make it as a TV show, and we were kind of going backwards and forwards, and the TV channel were kind of they weren't giving us a decision. So we decided we weren't going to do it. We're going to put it off for another year. So we thought, that's fine. We've got, you know. So, but then about 8 weeks before the event, they came back and they went, we've got the money to make the TV show now. We want to make it. And so we looked at it and we went, well, do we make the TV show and do it with 8 weeks of prep time? Or do we put it off another year and then potentially not make the show? So in the end, we just went, stuff it. Let's go in. So it was, it would have been nice to have had 6 months rather than 8 weeks to go in. But,
well, one of the champs in the competition said that if you're going to do a competition like that, you really need a year's preparation. And so competitors and spectators didn't really take you very seriously when they saw you in there. And the first few days of the competition sort of showed that out. But when did you feel that you were really getting somewhere? And how did you feel when you got your first clear?
Yeah, I mean, well, that was the thing, you know. It's one of those things where, like, it's hard to... it's sort of hard to describe just how difficult that is. Like, it's basically, every rider has to ride the same, course as the experts, you know? Mm. So you've got people like, you know, Dougie Lampkin, who, you know, like, Dougie is, you know, I consider him to be, you know, up there, you know, one of the greatest motorcyclists that's ever lived, you know? It's one of those things where, you know, there's, the people who, you know, there might be sort of MotoGP people or Superbike champions or, you know, even TT racers that are a lot more famous, you know. But, you know, like currently, like in the world, somebody like Tony Bow, you know, these guys are, their level of skill is like off, like it's superhuman, you know. And with that event, it's the sort of thing where, so the event itself, it's 6 days, it's through the Scottish Highlands, and every day you ride, it's the equivalent of about 180 kilometres, a lot of it's in thick, deep, boggy marsh, right, where your bike, unless you hit it flat out, your bike literally, you're up to your waist in bog, so you've got to just fly across it, and then 30 times a day, you stop, and there's a big, long hill climb in a big, rocky river with water coming down it, and you have to ride those sections without putting your feet down, and you do that every day for 6 days. So obviously, when I first turned up, you know, it's one of those things where there's people who've been watching the event for, you know, they've been watching the event for years, and it's so hard that there's a dropout rate of, like, you know, 50% of the people who enter. And we're talking about, like, this event is the sort of thing where, like, you know, really, really good, solid club riders will enter. But half the field don't finish, you know. So, so it was the sort of thing where there was a lot of, especially old men who have been watching it for years, who basically just went, why are you even here? Like, you don't, they didn't know that, they thought I'd just got off a road bike and gone, oh, I'll give this a try. They didn't know that I'd been riding trials and practicing for years, but anyway, the upshot was is that they just said, you know, you won't even last a day, you know. And Dougie Lampkin, who I've ridden with, so I know, he sort of said at the start he'd seen me ride, and he reckoned that I would get about. He thought I'd make it halfway, but he wasn't convinced that I would actually finish the thing. So it was sort of stacked against me. And but you know, it's one of those things where you just got to keep plodding on. You know, you just got to ignore the fact that, I mean, on the first day, because we hadn't had a chance to go and ride the moors, you know, and that's like, you know, that's half of the battle. So the first day, I probably went over the handlebars 10, 15 times, just because you're just hitting everything flat out, and then the front wheel digs in, and you just fly over the handlebars. So, you know, after, and then you get back on the bike, and the obvious thing to do is after you've had a big wipeout, the first thing you do is you think, all right, I need to take it easy. But you can't take it easy, because you've got to be on the gas all the time, or you fall off more. And then you're getting more and more tired. So as your skill level, like, you know, over the course of the week, you start to get your eye in, and you start to, you know, you get better as the week goes on. But as you're getting better, you're also getting more and more tired. So it's this sort of, and that goes on for 6 days. But no, I did it, and, you know, I mean, I didn't, I wasn't, you know, I wasn't, Dougie wasn't having any, he wasn't getting any, losing any sleep over me nipping at his heels, but, you know, to finish that event is kind of, you know, for me, that's, if you ask any trials rider, to finish the Scottish is, you know, that's something to be pleased with. So I'm glad I did it, because, I don't know if I'll, in 10 years' time, I don't know if I'll have the, I don't think I'll have the energy, you know.
Yeah, it's just similar to the Fink River race in Australia. To finish that is a feather in your cap, so... Mm,
just to finish something that tough.
The Fink Desert race.
Yeah.
Yes. That's on my list. That's my. We were gonna try and do that. We were gonna do that last year. Actually, that was our. We were looking at that. So, a friend of mine told me, an Aussie guy, and I said we were talking about the Fink, and. And I was asking him about it, you know, because it's, because again, that's one of those things where it's just fast, isn't it? It's just really fast. And he said, oh, I'm a record holder at the thing. And I said, oh, yeah, I didn't know that. I said, what? And he's a good rider, Dakar rider. I said, what record have you got? He said, fastest person ever airlifted to Alex.
Actually, Ross Phillip, the guy that we've got lined up after you have to leave us, has actually ridden in the Fink as well, and he said, yeah, it is an incredible race to ride, and without even meaning to, you actually start to really become competitive just because you don't want to be the tail light.
Right, well, because you don't want to... I rode across... So I did the Roof of Africa, that's in the Sutu down in South Africa there. But I also rode from Cape Town to like up through Namibia to Zambia, and I've done a couple of where else did I go? I did a separate trip round Zambia as well, and one of the things. And Morocco as well. I used to go down to Morocco and ride the old Dakar, you know, the old Dakar stage in Morocco. And that's one of the things that, one of the big things was, not getting in Africa, not getting in the dust, you know. Because as soon as you're trying to get a good speed, you know, because you want to be going fast enough that you're not, you know, you want to be on top of the sand. So you want to be going, you want to be doing about, you know, like, you know, 120 plus, you know, kilometers plus to truly be skipping across the the top of the sand. You know, but then the trouble is that you're going at that speed, and the guy in front of you is doing that sort of speed as well. You can't see anything, you know, so that's kind of... You want to be going fast so that you can be safe, but then at the same time, if you back off, so you're not going as fast, then you can't see, and you don't want to be going slowly without any vision. So, yeah, it's all swings and roundabouts, isn't it?
But, it is.
I've definitely got my eye on it. I watched that film, that Think There and Back, you know, with the guy that was, he's paralyzed, and I thought, bloody hell, if a guy's doing it without the use of his legs, then that's an inspiration to all of us, isn't it?
Mm, it certainly is.
Yeah.
Ross, we've all had oh no moments. Can you tell us about your most memorable, this is going to end in tears time?
Blimey. What some of the big ones. I had one when I was in I can't tell you the name of the because this is on the radio. When I was doing Romania, all I'll say is if you let's use the word fudge, right? Let's say the word fudge, right? There's a hill in Romania and it's called Johnny What the Fudge. and you can work that out.
Yeah.
Listen.
And
it's so steep that at one point I was halfway down it and a bike, I just heard clank, clank like that, and a bike cartwheeled over the top of my head and smashed against the tree. And about 3 seconds later, or less than that, half a second later, a bloke in full riding kit followed the bike. He obviously jumped off, and he went straight over my head like that. He'd obviously just misjudged the whole thing. That was interesting. Another one was I was flying across. We myself and the guy I was riding with we had radios in our helmets, and I was absolutely flying across this field. And there was this pack of, they've got these packs of wild dogs in Romania. Because you're in Transylvania, you know, it's the Carpathian Mountains.
Yeah.
And try explaining that. When I went to the hospital after I got back, I'd cut my hand open, it got a bit septic. But I just gaffer taped it up and I thought, I'll get it looked at when I get back to the UK. So I took the gaffer tape off and went to the hospital. And the woman went, all right, where did this incident take place? I went, Transylvania. and I had to show her the photos. I went, no, I genuinely was in Transylvania. But I was running along, and there's this pack of wild dogs. And because Romaniacs are so, you're just going over rocks and logs and all kinds of crazy stuff. So I was going flat out, and the bash plate under the bike had slipped across. So I couldn't change gear, so I was stuck in a really high gear. I was going flat out. And this pack of wild dogs sort of started to come running out. And there was this dog, and it was just up the track. And I was getting on the radio to my mate, and I went, the bash plate's stuck. And there's a wild dog, and this big dog was in the run. And I was just looking. I was literally looking at this dog. And it wasn't getting out of the way. And I was going to, and it was getting closer and closer and closer. And I thought, this dog's going to jump up. It's going to attack me. It's going to pull me off the bike, you know? And I genuinely thought, like, you know, I don't want to slow down because it's going to attack me. So I was riding. And my mate came in my ear, and he went, kick it! Kick it! So I was on one peg. It was on one peg, and I was getting my, getting my foot ready, and like just at the last minute, I was just swinging my leg, and the dog ran off, and I went, and he went, did you kick it? And I went, it ran off, and he went, no, you idiot, the bash plate. So I kicked the bash plate, and sure enough, it slid back into position, and I was able to change down to the gears, you know. So that was a bit of fun. I was at Phillip Island once, and I used to have a track bike. And I came off of Phillip Island, it was turn two, and I used to go down there, used to go down there quite a lot, you know. I would do sort of, I got right into that California Superbike school, you know. So I would go and do the school for a couple of days, and then I would go and do a couple of track days. So I started to get, you know, I started to get quite fast, you know. And I come round it, and I got to turn two, and I just lost it, and the bike just slid out, and I was like sliding across the tarmac. And I wasn't necessarily worried about me, because I just thought, oh, actually, as long as I don't snap anything. But I was watching my bike, there was a shower of sparks. And as it was sliding across towards the gravel, I was just looking at it in my head. I was just calculating the cost. And I was going, $200, $300, $400, $500. And then it hit the gravel, and it flipped up in the air. And then, like, I saw it starting to fly off, and I was like, oh, yeah, there you go, $2,000. You know, but yeah, I think that's the good thing about riding on the dirt, you know, is that you can crash a lot, and it doesn't really, you just bounce. Especially, I always forget though, because in the UK it's so muddy, you can just come off and you just slide, you know. Mm-hmm. Whereas over here, when it's a bit dusty, and you come off and the ground's a bit harder, you know. So it takes me a while to recalibrate when I'm over here.
Yeah, it would.
Yeah, just got to get used to it again. Ross, just a simple question. How much longer have you got for us?
I've still got, I've got a good 10 minutes.
Okay, good. Keep going.
Yeah.
Well, Ross, with all this stuff that you've been doing and all these rides that you go on and the competitions you go in, how do you balance an international career as a comedian with so much motorcycling? When do you have time to do both?
Well, that's the... Yeah, now you're starting to sound like my wife. Yeah.
He is wearing a skirt.
I mean, it's tricky because it's one of those things where it slid... I think it probably slid, you know, quite a bit. 2011, I pretty much took... I took most of the year off and just rode bikes, you know. That was, that was when I did Romaniacs, and I was, and I was doing all sorts of stuff. Going over to Africa and Morocco and all kinds of stuff. You know, so that was, it slid a bit the other way. And then I made a TV show back in 2007. I made a TV show where I rode around Australia. So that, I managed to combine the two. And then I made a program, in the UK, which was a comedy show, but I was on a motorbike traveling around Britain. So I did two series of that. So we filmed that for like 8 weeks, which was just 8 weeks, you chance to ride all over Britain. And then I've made a couple of documentaries, just bike documentaries, I would sort of laughably tell my wife that I was working, and then she would just point out that I was basically doing projects purely because it meant I could ride motorcycles. So that was tricky. And then a couple of times when I've been doing big tours in the UK, I would take James Burroughs, who was training me. I'd take him on tour with me. And we would have, a van that would have all the set and all the sound gear and all that sort of stuff in it. And the tour manager would drive that. And then James and I would have, a van. And in that van, we would have two enduro bikes, two trials bikes, and a couple of push bikes. And then we would basically, his job was to find places, off-road places where we could ride. And then we'd get up early in the morning, we'd ride until mid-afternoon, and then sometimes we'd drive straight to the show and just shower at the venue and then go straight on stage. So yeah, it's one of those things where if I can possibly work out a way of incorporating my riding into things, I will, you know.
Sounds perfect. Ross, now, if I just want to change a little bit of direction. Now, every guest that comes along here onto the show, does something for motorcycling, promotes it, charity, whatever. Now, you work for, you promote a charity called Riders for Health. Could you talk a little bit about that for us, please? Or what's it about?
That's quite ironic. I just started talking and a very loud motorbike just went past me. And I was like, come on, I'm trying to talk about motorbikes. they're called Two Wheels for Life now. And, they're a brilliant charity. So what they do is they raise money to provide, off-road motorcycles. Normally you can only buy them here and in Africa. The Yamaha ag bikes, you know, the AG 200.
Oh yeah, yep.
And so they're so what they do is they'll go into areas that need where health workers can't possibly reach people any other way than on a motorcycle, and they'll buy them the bikes, they'll teach them how to ride them, how to maintain them. And then also, you know, there's a lot of, because, you know, especially now, it's very topical at the moment, but, you know, with a lot of vaccinations, there needs to be that cool supply chain. So you can't, so you have to keep the vaccines, refrigerated. And obviously you can't do that if you're, if a health worker is having to walk out into these remote communities. So give them a bike, train them how to use it. And these bikes can reach huge areas of people. And I went over with them to Zambia and to Kenya as well. And the work they're doing, it's really simple, because, you know, what tended to happen before they came along was these charities would buy very expensive four-wheel drive vehicles, and of course, as soon as they break down, they can't get the parts, and these things are just left lying around the place, and as soon as they break, that's game over, you know. Whereas Two Wheels for Life they've never had to retire one of their bikes. They can constantly keep them on the road, and it literally, I think it's some sort of crazy statistic, but as soon as you put a health worker on one of those bikes in an area, in a district in these countries, the rate of infant death just absolutely plummets, you know. It's incredibly effective, and what I love about it is the fact that the thing that we all do just for a laugh, you know, just because we for a hobby, is sort of genuinely saving people's lives, you know. And a lot of the health workers are, a lot of the nurses are women as well, you know. So that's always great to see. You know, you go and ride with them, and you'll get, lovely women all just riding around on dirt bikes, you know, which is quite a, it's quite a nice tonic from when you turn up to races, and it's just loads of testosterone fueled blokes.
I can imagine.
There's a chance for me yet.
Two Wheels for Life is the charity, if you want to look it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've written that down. Thanks. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a classic case of a low tech solution to a high tech problem, and countries like. Countries in Africa and in Asia, that's really the best way to go. High tech is not always the best way.
Yeah, because these... Kathy's brother-in-law has had a Yami ag bike like that, a little 175, and honestly, it was unkillable. I reckon you could drop it. It was like the Top Gear Toyota that they thrashed. you could do anything.
They're absolutely they're absolutely bomb proof, you know. Yeah. And they just go and go and go. So
exactly. So, no, it sounds like it's a well worthwhile group to be supporting, because you know, that's where you can make a massive amount of difference. We've had people here in the show, motorcyclists generally, I think, they've got very short pockets and very, very long arms. If there's ever a fundraising that needs to be done, get a group of motorcyclists involved, and it's amazing what happens every single time.
Yeah, well, our tour run is an example of that. We have over 5,000 motorcyclists in Adelaide who dig very, very deep and help out children who are in need. So that's a positive. We'll have to get you over for that one day.
Yeah, if I'm in town when it's happening, I'll definitely join you.
It's worth it. There's nothing, you know, the tunnels going on the South Eastern Freeway. If you're in that with a group of Harleys in front of you and they all drop two or three gears lower, and so you've got one hell of a noise going through there, it's magnificent.
Yeah.
And we don't ride Harleys, by the way.
I thought this show was about motorcycles.
Exactly.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, I love that one. Oh, can I use that one too?
I'm joking. I'm absolutely joking. We did a ride out. In fact, I think it's on. I think it's on YouTube. We did a ride in the UK, where we all got together, and there was I think it was about 300 bikes. I led a procession of 300 bikes, and that's one of those things where when you're at the front, it wasn't until we went round a roundabout, like, you know, you go over a bridge and then down a lower bridge, and you look across and you see this massive line of bikes. It's pretty
Brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's, now, Ross, a question we haven't asked yet, haven't been game to. How many bikes have you got?
When I moved back to Australia, I had a bit of a clear out, because I was up to, I think I had about 15 bikes at one point. I went through a stage where I thought that it was a good idea to have a bike for every discipline. So I had a two-stroke enduro, I had a four-stroke, I had an adventure bike, a track bike, I had a supermoto. It was basically all of the above, you know, and then a street fighter and all that. So at the moment, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4. I've only got 5 bikes at the moment, so I've got three trials bikes. I've got my enduro bike is KTM 350 four stroke, which is I think for the Australian conditions is perfect. You know, I was riding the 300 two-stroke KTM to do more of the extreme stuff, but actually I've been taking the 350 to Wildwood, which is like an extreme, you know, sort of trialsy extreme enduro place, weirdly that's you know, the 350 will still do it. The 300 is. It's the tool for the job, but yeah, you know, you can still, it's a bit like driving a bus over rocks and stuff, but it's still more capable. So that's my current enduro bike, the KTM 350. And then I've got a super adventure, KTM super adventure. That's my, I say it's my road bike, but I've got knobbly tires on it, and I've fitted a load of crash protection. And to be honest, I ride that off road all the time. You know, I think I showed you the pictures. Yeah. Like I get so annoyed with people who basically have this attitude that those big adventure bikes aren't suitable to be taken off road. As me and a mate of mine, we set up trial sessions for them, and then smash them around over over, you know, crazy off-road stuff, just as a way of saying, you know, these are not. I think a lot of times people look at those big, adventure bikes, and they sort of they look at them a bit like people that buy Land Rovers and only drive them to the shops, you know. So yeah, mine is constantly it's constantly caked in mud, and that's officially, that's my road bike.
Yeah. Right, fair enough.
Yeah.
So, yeah, our bikes mostly, only time they're on the bitumen is when we're crossing it.
Yeah. Ross, unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time. I've got some station commitments, some sponsorship commitments I've got to run through.
That's all right. They're waiting for me to do a sound check.
Okay. Ross,
it's worked out nicely.
Right. Now, look, thank you very, very much, and we'd love to hear from you again. So if at any time you're sort of at a loose end and you want to talk some more motorcycling without your wife there, we'd be more than happy to...
Ooh, them spiky words.
I think
you know what? The next time I come to Adelaide, if I haven't got a show, then I'll come in and talk in person. The show's at 8:10 every night at Gluttony. I'm here until, when am I here? Until Sunday.
Sunday's
the last show. So, and at the end of the show, I always ask if there's any questions, and I'm more than happy to answer bike-related stuff while the rest of the audience yawn and roll their eyes.
You're on.
So, yeah, I'll talk to you the next time I'm in town.
Sure. Thank you very, very much, Ross. Catch up with you.
Good luck.
All right, lovely. Take care.
Good night.
Bye.
And that was Ross Noble. He now has to go and perform at the Adelaide Fringe. Now, we've got some station commitments to meet.